atmosphere, advantage for melodies, musical chords, environmental sounds, and tones of voice. Similar differences have been found for other senses as well. We know, for instance, that the right hand, sensation from which projects almost entirely to the left hemisphere, is better able to discriminate the order of stimuli, while the left hand is more sensitive to their spatial characteristics. However, the right hemisphere is dominant for many higher cognitive abilities, both in normal brains and in those that have been surgically divided. It tends to have an advantage when reading faces, intuiting geometrical principles and spatial relationships, perceiving holes from a collection of parts, and judging musical chords. The right hemisphere is also better at displaying emotion with the left side of the face, and at detecting emotions in others. Interestingly, this obliges us to view one another's least expressive side of the face, the right, with our most emotionally astute hemisphere, the right, and vice versa. Psychopaths generally do not show this right hemisphere advantage for the perception of emotion. Perhaps this is one reason why they are bad at detecting emotional distress in others. Most evidence suggests that the two hemispheres differ in temperament, and it now seems uncontroversial to say that they can make different and even opposing contributions to a person's emotional life. In a divided brain, the hemispheres are unlikely to perceive self and world in the same way, nor are they likely to feel the same way about them. Much of what makes us human is generally accomplished by the right side of the brain. Consequently, we have every reason to believe that the disconnected right hemisphere is independently conscious, and that the divided brain harbors two distinct points of view. This fact poses an insurmountable problem for the notion that each of us has a single, indivisible self, much less an immortal soul. The idea of a soul arises from the feeling that our subjectivity has a unity, simplicity, and integrity that must somehow transcend the biochemical wheelworks of the body. But the split-brain phenomenon proves that our subjectivity can quite literally be sliced in two. This is why Sir John Eccles, a neuroscientist and committed Christian, declared against all evidence that the right hemisphere of the divided brain must be unconscious. This fact also has interesting ethical repercussions. For instance, the biologist Lee Silver wonders what we should do if a person with a split brain wanted to have her right hemisphere removed because she could no longer endure the conflict with her other self. Would this be a therapeutic intervention or a murder? However, the most important implications are for our view of consciousness. It is divisible, and therefore more fundamental than any apparent self. Imagine undergoing a complete cholecystectomy. Like most surgeries of this kind, you could be kept awake, because there are no pain receptors in the brain. There's also no reason to think that you would lose consciousness during the procedure, because a person can have an entire hemisphere removed, a hemispherectomy, without the loss of consciousness. Nor would you suffer any lapse in memory. After surgery, you would tend to speak in a way characteristic of alexithymia, the inability to describe your emotional life. And you might also demonstrate an inappropriate degree of politeness. Whether or not you had occasion to notice these changes in yourself, it seems all but certain that you would retain your sense of being a self throughout the experience. Given that each hemisphere in your divided brain would have its own point of view, whereas you now appear to have only one, it is natural to wonder which side of the longitudinal fissure you would find yourself on once the corpus callosum was cut. Would you land on the right or the left? It is hard to resist the uncanny demands of arithmetic here. Assuming that you were not simply extinguished and replaced by two new subjects, which seems ruled out by the fact that you would probably remain conscious throughout the procedure and retain your memories, it is tempting to conclude that your subjectivity must collapse to a single hemisphere. Once the surgery was over, it would be obvious that you can't be on both sides of the Great Divide. Perhaps it is reasonable to believe that you would find yourself in the left hemisphere, retaining the reins of speech, since speech and discursive thinking do much to define your experience in the present. But consider some of the other cognitive abilities you now consciously enjoy, which we know are governed primarily by your right hemisphere. Who, for instance, would greet your loved ones with your left hand and effortlessly recognize their faces, their facial expressions, and their tones of voice? I think this riddle admits of a rather straightforward solution. Consciousness, whatever its relation to neural events, is divisible. And just as it isn't shared between the brains of separate individuals, it need not be shared between the hemispheres of a single brain once the structures that facilitate such sharing have been cut. If some way of linking two brains with an artificial commissure were ever devised, we should expect that what had been two distinct persons would be unified in the only sense that consciousness is ever unified, as a single point of view, and unified in the only sense that minds are ever unified, by virtue of common contents and functional abilities. The experience of dreaming is instructive here. Each night we lie down to sleep, only to be stolen from our beds and plunged into a realm where our personal histories and the laws of nature no longer apply. Generally, we do not retain enough of a purchase on reality to even notice that anything out of the ordinary has happened. The most astonishing quality of dreams is surely our lack of astonishment when they arise. The sleeping brain seems to have no expectation of continuity from one moment to the next. This is probably owing to the diminished activity in the frontal lobes that occurs during REM sleep. Thus, sweeping changes in our experience do not in principle detract from the unity of consciousness. Left to its own devices, consciousness seems happy to just experience one thing after the next. If my brain harbors only one conscious point of view, if all that is remembered, intended, and perceived is known by a single subject, then I enjoy unity of mind. The evidence is overwhelming, however, that such unity, if it ever exists in a human being, depends upon some humble tracts of white matter crossing the midline of the brain. Are our minds already split? Roger Sperry and his colleagues demonstrated in the 1950s that the corpus callosum cannot facilitate a complete transfer of learning between the cerebral hemispheres. After cutting the optic chiasma in cats, thereby confining the inputs of each eye to a single hemisphere, they discovered that only simple learning acquired through one eye could transfer to the other side of the brain. Given the immense amount of information processing that takes place in each hemisphere, it seems certain that even a normal human brain will be functionally split to one or another degree. 200 million nerve fibers seem insufficient to integrate the simultaneous activity of 20 billion neurons in the cerebral cortex, each of which makes hundreds or thousands, sometimes tens of thousands, of connections to its neighbors. Given this partitioning of information, how can our brains not harbor multiple centers of consciousness even now? The philosopher Roland Puccetti once observed that the existence of separate spheres of consciousness in the normal brain would explain one of the most perplexing features of split-brain research. Why is it that the right hemisphere is generally willing to bear silent witness to the errors and confabulations of the left? Could it be that the right hemisphere is used to it? An answer consistent with the hypothesis of mental duality in the normal human brain suggests itself. The non-speaking hemisphere has known the true state of affairs from a very tender age. It has known this because beginning at age 2 or 3, it heard speech emanating from the common body that, as language development on the left proceeded, became too complex grammatically and syntactically for it to believe it was generating. The same, of course, for what it observed the preferred hand writing down in school through the years. Post-surgically, little has changed for the mute hemisphere, other than the loss of sensory information about the ipsilateral half of bodily space. Being inured to the status of cerebral helot, it goes along. Thankless cooperation can become a way of life. Take a moment to absorb how bizarre this possibility is. The point of view from which you are consciously hearing these words may not be the only conscious point of view to be found in your brain. It is one thing to say that you are unaware of a vast amount of activity in your brain. It is quite another to say that some of this activity is aware of itself and is watching your every move. There must be a reason why the structural integrity of the corpus callosum creates a functional unity of mind, insofar as it does. And perhaps it is only the division of the corpus callosum that makes for separated regions of consciousness in the human brain. But whatever the final lesson of the split brain is, it thoroughly violates our common sense intuitions about the nature of our subjectivity. A person's experience of the world, while apparently unified in a normal brain, can be physically divided. The problem this poses for the study of consciousness may be insurmountable. If I were to interrogate my brain with the help of a colleague, one who is willing to expose my cortex and begin probing with a microelectrode, neither of us would know what to make of a region that failed to influence the contents of, quote, my consciousness. The split-brain phenomenon suggests that all that I would be able to say is whether I, as perhaps only one among many centers of consciousness to be found in my brain, felt anything when my friend applied the current. Feeling nothing, I wouldn't know whether the neurons in question constituted a region of consciousness in their own right, for the simple reason that I might be just like a split-brain patient given to wonder with his articulate left hemisphere whether or not his right hemisphere is conscious. It surely is, and yet no amount of experimental probing on his part will drive the relevant facts into view. As long as we must correlate changes in the brain, or any other physical system, with first-person reports, any physical systems that are functionally mute may nevertheless prove to be conscious, and our attempt to understand the causes of consciousness will fail to take them into account. All brains and persons may be split to one or another degree. Each of us may live, even now, in a fluid state of split and overlapping subjectivity. Whether or not this seems plausible to you may not be the point. Another part of your brain may see the matter differently. Conscious and unconscious processing in the brain. The frontier between conscious and unconscious mental processes has fascinated psychologists and neuroscientists for more than a century. The realization that the unconscious mind must have some cognitive and emotional structure was the foundation of Freud's work, and also the stage upon which he erected an impressively unscientific mythology. The connection between conscious thoughts and unconscious processes was also present in the work of William James, whose views on this topic, and on the mind in general, still deserve our attention. Suppose we try to recall a forgotten name. The state of our consciousness is peculiar. There is a gap therein, but no mere gap. It is a gap that is intensely active. A sort of wraith of the name is in it, beckoning us in a given direction, making us at moments tingle with the sense of our closeness, and then letting us sink back without the longed-for term. If wrong names are proposed to us, this singularly definite gap acts immediately so as to negate them. They do not fit into its mold. And the gap of one word does not feel like the gap of another. All empty of content as they both might seem necessarily to be when described as gaps, the rhythm of a lost word may be there without a sound to clothe it, or the evanescent sense of something which is the initial vowel or consonant may mock us fitfully, without growing more distinct. In other words, the unconscious mind exists, and our conscious experience gives some indication of its structure. Recent advances in experimental psychology and neuroimaging have allowed us to study the boundary between conscious and unconscious mental processes with increasing precision. We now know that at least two systems in the brain, often referred to as dual processes, govern human cognition, emotion, and behavior. One is evolutionarily older, unconscious, and automatic. The other evolved more recently and is both conscious and deliberative. When you find another person annoying, sexually attractive, or inadvertently funny, you are experiencing the percolations of System 1. The heroic efforts you make to conceal these feelings out of politeness are the work of System 2. Scientists have learned how to target System 1 through the phenomenon of priming, revealing that complex mental processes lurk beneath the level of conscious awareness. The experimental technique of backward masking has been at the center of this research. Human beings can consciously perceive very brief visual stimuli, down to about 1/30th of a second. But we can no longer see these images if they are immediately followed by a dissimilar pattern, a mask. This fact allows for words and pictures to be delivered to the mind subliminally, and these stimuli have subsequent effects on a person's cognition and behavior. For instance, you will be faster to recognize that ocean is a word if it follows a related prime, like wave, than if it follows an unrelated one, like hammer. And emotionally charged terms are more easily recognized than neutral ones. The word sex can be presented more briefly than the word car, which further demonstrates that the meanings of words must be gleaned prior to consciousness. Subliminally promised rewards drive activity in the brain's reward centers, and masked, fearful faces and emotional words increase activity in the amygdala. Clearly, we are not aware of all the information that influences our thoughts, feelings, and actions. Many other findings attest to the importance of our unconscious mental lives. Amnesiacs who can no longer form conscious memories can still improve their performance on a wide variety of tasks through practice. For instance, a person can learn to play golf with increasing proficiency, all the while believing that whenever she picks up a club, it is for the first time. The acquisition of such motor skills occurs outside of consciousness in normal people as well. Your conscious memories of practicing a musical instrument, driving a car, or tying your shoelaces are neurologically distinct from your learning how to do these things and from your knowing how to do them now. People with amnesia can even learn new facts and have their ability to recognize names and generate concepts improve in response to prior exposure without having any memory of acquiring such knowledge. In fact, we are all in this position with respect to most of our semantic knowledge of the world. Do you remember learning the meaning of the word door? Probably not. How do you recognize it and bring its meaning to mind? You have no idea. These processes occur outside of consciousness. Consciousness is what matters. Despite the obvious importance of the unconscious mind, consciousness is what matters to us, not just for the purpose of spiritual practice, but in every aspect of our lives. Consciousness is the substance of any experience we can have or hope for, now or in the future. If God spoke to Moses out of a burning bush, the bush would have been a visual percept, whether veridical or not, of which Moses was consciously aware. It should be clear that if a person begins to suffer from intractable pain or depression, if he experiences a continuous ringing in his ears, or the consequences of having acquired a bad reputation among his colleagues, these developments are matters of consciousness and its contents, whatever the nature of the unconscious processes that give rise to them. Consciousness is also what gives our lives a moral dimension. Without consciousness, we would have no cause to wonder how we should behave toward other human beings, nor could we care about how we were treated in return. Granted, many moral emotions and intuitions operate unconsciously, but it is because they influence the contents of consciousness that they matter to us. I have argued elsewhere and at length in The Moral Landscape that we have ethical responsibilities toward other creatures precisely to the degree that our actions can affect their conscious experience for better or worse. We don't have ethical obligations toward rocks on the assumption that they are not conscious, but we do have such obligations toward any creature that can suffer or be deprived of happiness. Of course, it can be wrong to destroy rocks if they happen to be valuable to other conscious creatures. The Taliban's destruction of the 1,500-year-old standing Buddhas of Bamiyan was wrong not from the perspective of the statues themselves, but from that of all the people who cared about them and the future people who might have cared. I have never come across a coherent notion of bad or good, right or wrong, desirable or undesirable, that did not depend upon some change in the experience of conscious creatures. It's not always easy to nail down what we mean by good and bad, and their definitions remain perpetually open to revision, but such judgments seem to require, in every instance, that some difference register at the level of experience. Why would it be wrong to murder a billion human beings? Because so much pain and suffering would result. Why would it be wrong to painlessly kill every man, woman, and child in their sleep? Because of all the possibilities for future happiness that would be foreclosed. If you think such actions are wrong primarily because they would anger God or would lead to your punishment after death, you are still worried about perturbations of consciousness, albeit ones that stand a good chance of being wholly imaginary. I take it to be axiomatic, therefore, that our notions of meaning, morality, and value presuppose the actuality of consciousness, or its loss, somewhere. If anyone has a conception of meaning, morality, and value that has nothing to do with the experience of conscious beings, in this world or in a world to come, I have yet to hear of it. And it would seem that such a conception of value could hold no interest for anyone, by definition, because it would be guaranteed to be outside the experience of every conscious being, now and in the future. The fact that the universe is illuminated where you stand, that your thoughts and moods and sensations have a qualitative character in this moment, is a mystery, exceeded only by the mystery that there should be something rather than nothing in the first place. Although science may ultimately show us how to truly maximize human well-being, it may still fail to dispel the fundamental mystery of our being itself. That doesn't leave much scope for conventional religious beliefs, but it does offer a deep foundation for a contemplative life. Many truths about ourselves will be discovered in consciousness directly, or not discovered at all. Chapter 3. The Riddle of the Self. I once spent an afternoon on the northwestern shore of the Sea of Galilee, atop the mount where Jesus is believed to have preached his most famous sermon. It was an infernally hot day, and the sanctuary where I sat was crowded with Christian pilgrims from many continents. Some gathered silently in the shade, while others staggered about in the sun taking photographs. As I gazed at the surrounding hills, a feeling of peace came over me. It soon grew to a blissful stillness that silenced my thoughts. In an instant, the sense of being a separate self, an I or a me, vanished. Everything was as it had been: the cloudless sky, the brown hills sloping to an inland sea, the pilgrims clutching their bottles of water. But I no longer felt separate from the scene, peering out at a world from behind my eyes. Only the world remained. The experience lasted just a few seconds, but it returned many times as I looked out over the land where Jesus is believed to have walked, gathered his apostles, and worked many of his miracles. If I were a Christian, I would undoubtedly have interpreted this experience in Christian terms. I might believe that I had glimpsed the oneness of God, or had been touched by the Holy Spirit. If I were a Hindu, I might think in terms of Brahman, the eternal self, of which the world and all individual minds are thought to be a mere modification. If I were a Buddhist, I might talk about the Dharmakaya of emptiness, in which all apparent things manifest as in a dream. But I am simply someone who is making his best effort to be a rational human being. Consequently, I am very slow to draw metaphysical conclusions from experiences of this sort. And yet I glimpse what I will call the intrinsic selflessness of consciousness every day, whether at a traditional holy site, or at my desk, or while having my teeth cleaned. This is not an accident. I've spent many years practicing meditation, the purpose of which is to cut through the illusion of the self. My goal in this chapter and the next is to convince you that the conventional sense of self is an illusion, and that spirituality largely consists in realizing this moment to moment. There are logical and scientific reasons to accept this claim, but recognizing it to be true is not a matter of understanding these reasons. Like many illusions, the sense of self disappears when closely examined, and this is done through the practice of meditation. Once again, I am suggesting an experiment that you must conduct for yourself, in the laboratory of your own mind, by paying attention to your experience in a new way. The Buddha's famous parable meant to denigrate mere intellectualism seems apropos here. A man is struck in the chest with a poison arrow. A surgeon rushes to his side to begin the work of saving his life. But the man resists these ministrations. He first wants to know the name of the fletcher who fashioned the arrow's shaft, the genus of the wood from which it was cut, the disposition of the man who shot it, the name of the horse upon which he rode, and 1,000 other things that have no bearing upon his present suffering or his ultimate survival. The man needs to get his priorities straight. His commitment to thinking about the world results from a basic misunderstanding of his predicament. And though we may be only dimly aware of it, we too have a problem that will not be solved by acquiring more conceptual knowledge. Little has changed since the Buddha's time. Many people claim to have no interest at all in spiritual life. Indeed, most scientists and philosophers disdain the subject, for it suggests a neglect of intellectual standards. Bliss, it has been noted, is not conducive to detached observation. And yet we are all seeking fulfillment while living at the mercy of changing experience. Whatever we acquire in life gets dispersed. Our bodies age. Our relationships fall away. Even the most intense pleasures last only a few moments. And every morning, we are chased out of bed by our thoughts. In this chapter, I will invoke a variety of concepts that have yet to do much useful work in our study of the natural world, or even of the brain, but do very heavy lifting throughout the course of our lives. Concepts such as self and ego and I. Admittedly, these terms appear less than scientific, but we have no new words with which to name and subsequently study one of the most striking features of our existence. Most of us feel that our experience of the world refers back to a self, not to our bodies precisely, but to a center of consciousness that exists somehow interior to the body, behind the eyes, inside the head. The feeling that we call I seems to define our point of view in every moment. And it also provides an anchor for popular beliefs about souls and freedom of will. And yet this feeling, however imperturbable it may appear at present, can be altered, interrupted, or entirely abolished. Such transformations run the gamut from run-of-the-mill psychosis to spiritual epiphany. What makes me the same person I was 5 minutes ago, or yesterday, or on my 18th birthday? Is it that I remember being those former selves, and my memories are somewhat accurate? In fact, I've forgotten most of what has happened to me over the course of my life, and my body has been gradually changing all the while. Is it enough to say that I'm physically continuous with my former selves, because most of the cells in my body are the same as, or descended from, those that made up the bodies of those younger men? As we have seen, the split-brain phenomenon puts pressure on the very idea of personal identity. But things can get even worse. In a now-famous thought experiment, the philosopher Derek Parfit asks us to imagine a teleportation device that can beam a person from Earth to Mars. Rather than travel many months on a spaceship, you need only enter a small chamber close to home and push a green button, and all the information in your brain and body will be sent to a similar station on Mars, where you will be reassembled down to the last atom. Imagine that several of your friends have already traveled to Mars this way, and seem none the worse for it. They describe the experience as being one of instantaneous relocation. You push the green button and find yourself standing on Mars, where your most recent memory is of pushing the green button on Earth and wondering if anything would happen. So you decide to travel to Mars yourself. However, in the process of arranging your trip, you learn a troubling fact about the mechanics of teleportation. It turns out that the technicians wait for a person's replica to be built on Mars before obliterating his original body on Earth. This has the benefit of leaving nothing to chance. If something goes wrong in the replication process, no harm has been done. However, it raises the following concern. While your double is beginning his day on Mars with all your memories, goals, and prejudices intact, you will be standing in the teleportation chamber on Earth, just staring at the green button. Imagine a voice coming over the intercom to congratulate you for arriving safely at your destination. In a few moments, you are told, your Earth body will be smashed to atoms. How would this be any different from simply being killed? To most readers, this thought experiment will suggest that psychological continuity, the mere maintenance of one's memories, beliefs, habits, and other mental traits, is an insufficient basis for personal identity. It's not enough for someone on Mars to be just like you. He must actually be you. The man on Mars will share all your memories and will behave exactly as you would have. But he is not you, as your continued existence in the teleportation chamber on Earth attests. To the Earth you, awaiting obliteration, teleportation as a means of travel will appear a horrifying sham. You never left Earth and are about to die. Your friends, you now realize, have been repeatedly copied and killed. And yet the problem with teleportation is somehow not obvious if a person is disassembled before his replica is built. In that case, it's tempting to say that teleportation works, and that he is really stepping onto the surface of Mars. One might conclude that personal identity requires physical continuity. I am identical to my brain and body, and if they get destroyed, that's the end of me. But Parfit shows that physical continuity matters only because it normally supports psychological continuity. Merely hanging on to one's brain and body cannot be an end in itself. Just consider the unfortunate case of someone with advanced dementia. He is physically but not psychologically continuous with the person he used to be. If he could be given new neurons that would emulate the old ones in his healthy brain, restoring his memories, creativity, sense of humor, this would be far better than keeping his current neurons that are succumbing to neurodegenerative disease. If we grant that the gradual replacement of individual neurons would be compatible with continued consciousness, it seems clear that the maintenance of psychological continuity is what we care about, and it is generally what we mean by a person's survival from one moment to the next. Parfit pushes the concept of personal identity about as far as it can go and resolves the apparent paradox of teleportation by arguing that, quote, identity is not what matters. Rather, we should be concerned only about psychological continuity. However, he also states that psychological continuity cannot take a, quote, branching form, or at least not for long, as it does when a person is copied on Mars while the original person survives on Earth. Parfit believes that we should view the teleportation case in which a person is destroyed before being replicated as more or less indistinguishable from the normal pattern of personal survival throughout our lives. After all, in what way are you subjectively the same as the person who first began listening to this book? In the only way that you can be, by displaying some degree of psychological continuity with that past self. Viewed in this way, it is difficult to see how teleportation is any different from the mere passage of time. As Parfit says, quote, I want the person on Mars to be me in a specially intimate way in which no future person will ever be me. What I fear will be missing is always missing. Ordinary survival is about as bad as being destroyed and replicated. Here Parfit does not mean bad in the sense that we should find these truths depressing. He is merely arguing that ordinary survival from moment to moment is no more demonstrative of personal identity than destruction and replication would be. Parfit's view of the self, which he appears to have arrived at independently through an immensely creative use of thought experiments, is essentially the same as the one found in the teachings of Buddhism. There is no stable self that is carried along from one moment to the next. I agree with most of what Parfit has to say about personal identity. However, because his view is purely the product of logical argument, it can seem uncannily detached from the reality of our lives. Although experience and meditation may not immediately resolve the teleportation paradox, or make it clear why one should care about one's future experience any more than that of a stranger, it can make these philosophical problems easier to think about. When talking about psychological continuity, we are talking about consciousness and its contents, the persistence of autobiographical memories in particular. Everything that is personal, everything that differentiates my consciousness from that of another human being, relates to the contents of consciousness. Memories, perceptions, attitudes, desires, these are appearances in consciousness. If my consciousness were suddenly filled with the contents of your life, if I awoke this morning with your memories, hopes, fears, sensory impressions, and relationships, I would no longer be me. I would be the same as your clone in the teleportation case. My consciousness is, quote, mine, only because the particularities of my life are illuminated as and where they arise. For instance, I currently have an annoying pain in my neck, the result of a martial arts injury. Why is this my pain? Why am I the only one who is directly aware of it? These questions are a symptom of confusion. There is no I who is aware of the pain. The pain is simply arising in consciousness in the only place it can arise, at the conjunction of this brain and this neck. Where else could this particular pain be felt? If I were cloned through teleportation, an identical pain might be felt in an identical neck on Mars, but this pain would still be right here in this neck. Whatever its relation to the physical world, consciousness is the context in which the objects of experience appear. The sound of my reading this book, the sensation of your back against a chair. There is nowhere else for them to appear. For their very appearance is consciousness in action. And anything that is unique to your experience of the world must appear amid the contents of consciousness. We have every reason to believe that these contents depend upon the physical structure of your brain. Duplicate your brain, and you will duplicate, quote, your contents in another field of consciousness. Divide your brain, and you will segregate these contents in bizarre ways. We know from experiments both real and imagined that psychological continuity is divisible and can, therefore, be inherited by more than one mind. If my brain were surgically divided by colostomy tomorrow, this would create at least two independent conscious minds, both of which would be psychologically continuous with the person who is now writing this paragraph. If my linguistic abilities happened to be distributed across both hemispheres, each of these minds might remember having written this sentence. The question of whether I would land in the left hemisphere or the right doesn't make sense, being based as it is on the illusion that there is a self bobbing on the stream of consciousness like a boat on the water. But the stream of consciousness can divide and follow both tributaries simultaneously. Should these tributaries converge again, the final current would inherit the memories of each. If, after years of living apart, my hemispheres were reunited, their memories of separate existence could, in principle, appear in the combined memory of a single consciousness. There would be no cause to ask where my self had been while my brain was divided, because no I exists apart from the stream. The moment we see this, the divisibility of the human mind begins to seem less paradoxical. Subjectively speaking, the only thing that actually exists is consciousness and its contents, and the only thing relevant to the question of personal identity is psychological continuity from one moment to the next. What are we calling I? One thing each of us knows for certain is that reality vastly exceeds our awareness of it. I am, for instance, sitting at my desk, drinking coffee. Gravity is holding me in place, and the manner in which this is accomplished eludes us to this day. The integrity of my chair is the result of the electrical bonds between atoms, entities I have never seen but which I know must exist, in some sense, with or without my knowledge. The coffee is dissipating heat at a rate that could be calculated with precision, and the second law of thermodynamics decrees that it is, on balance, losing heat every moment rather than gathering it from the cup or the surrounding air. None of this is evident to me from direct experience, however. Forces of digestion and metabolism are at work within me that are utterly beyond my perception or control. Most of my internal organs may as well not exist for all I know of them directly, and yet I can be reasonably certain that I have them, arranged much as any medical textbook would suggest. The taste of the coffee, my satisfaction at its flavor, the feeling of the warm cup in my hand, while these are immediate facts with which I am acquainted, they reach back into a dark wilderness of facts I will never come to know. I have neurons firing and forming new connections in my brain every instant, and these events determine the character of my experience. but I know nothing directly about the electrochemical activity of my brain. And yet this soggy miracle of computation appears to be working for the moment and generating a vision of a world. The more I persist in this line of thought, the clearer it becomes I perceive scarcely a scintilla of all that exists to be known. I can, for instance, reach for my cup of coffee and set it down, seemingly as I please. These are intentional actions, and I perform them. But if I look for what underlies these movements, motor neurons, muscle fibers, neurotransmitters, I can't feel or see a thing. And how do I initiate this behavior? I haven't a clue. In what sense, then, do I initiate it? That is difficult to say. The feeling that I intended to do what I just did seems to be only that, a feeling of some internal signature. Perhaps the result of my brain's having formed a predictive model of its ensuing actions. It may not be best classified as a feeling, but surely it is something. Otherwise, how could I note the difference between voluntary and involuntary behavior? Without this impression of agency, I would feel that my actions were automatic or otherwise beyond my control. One question immediately presents itself. Where am I that I have such a poor view of things? And what sort of thing am I that both my outside and my inside are so obscure? An outside and inside of what? My skin? Am I identical to my skin? If not, and the answer is clearly no, why should the frontier between my outside and my inside be drawn at the skin? If not at the skin, then where does the outside of me stop and the inside of me begin? At my skull? Am I my skull? Am I inside my skull? Let's say yes for the moment, because we are quickly running out of places to look for me. Where inside my skull might I be? And if I'm up here in my head, how's the rest of me me, let alone the inside of me? The pronoun I is the name most of us put to the sense that we are the thinkers of our thoughts and the experiencers of our experience. It is the sense that we have of possessing, rather than of merely being, a continuum of experience. We will see, however, that this feeling is not a necessary property of the mind, and the fact that people report losing their sense of self to one or another degree suggests that the experience of being a self can be selectively interfered with. Obviously, there is something in our experience that we are calling I, apart from the sheer fact that we are conscious. Otherwise, we would never describe our subjectivity in the way that we do, and a person would have no basis for feeling that she had lost her sense of self, whatever the circumstances. Nevertheless, it is extremely difficult to pinpoint just what it is we take ourselves to be. Many philosophers have noticed this problem, but few in the West have understood that the failure to locate the self can produce more than mere confusion. I suspect that this difference between Eastern and Western philosophy has something to do with the influence of Abrahamic religion and its doctrine of the soul. Christianity, in particular, presents impressive obstacles to thinking intelligently about the nature of the human mind, asserting as it does the real existence of individual souls who are subject to the eternal judgment of God. What does it mean to say that the self cannot be found, or that it is illusory? It is not to say that people are illusory. I see no reason to doubt that each of us exists, or that the ongoing history of our personhood can be conventionally described as the history of our, quote, selves. But the self in this more global, biographical sense undergoes sweeping changes over the course of a lifetime. While you are in many ways physically and psychologically continuous with the person you were at age 7, your life has surely been punctuated by transitions that significantly changed you. Marriage, divorce, college, military service, parenthood, bereavement, serious illness, fame, exposure to other cultures, imprisonment, professional success, loss of a job, religious conversion. Each of us knows what it is like to develop new capacities, understandings, opinions, and tastes over the course of time. It is convenient to ascribe these changes to the self. That is not the self I am talking about. The self that does not survive scrutiny is the subject of experience in each present moment, the feeling of being a thinker inside one's head, the sense of being an owner or inhabitant of a physical body, which this false self seems to appropriate as a kind of vehicle. Even if you don't believe such a homunculus exists, perhaps because you believe on the basis of science that you are identical to your body and brain rather than a ghostly resident therein, you almost certainly feel like an internal self in almost every waking moment. And yet, however one looks for it, this self is nowhere to be found. It cannot be seen amid the particulars of experience, and it cannot be seen when experience itself is viewed as a totality. However, its absence can be found, and when it is, the feeling of being a self disappears. consciousness without self. This is an empirical claim. Look closely enough at your own mind in the present moment, and you will discover that the self is an illusion. The problem with a claim of this kind, however, is that one can't borrow another person's contemplative tools to test it. To see how the feeling of I is a product of thought, indeed to even appreciate how distracted by thought you tend to be in the first place, you have to build your own contemplative tools. Unfortunately, this leads many people to dismiss the project out of hand. They look inside, notice nothing of interest, and conclude that introspection is a dead end. But just imagine where astronomy would be if centuries after Galileo, a person were still obliged to build his own telescope before he could even judge whether astronomy was a legitimate field of inquiry. It wouldn't make the sky any less worthy of investigation, but astronomy's development as a science would become immensely more difficult. A few pharmacological shortcuts exist, and I discuss some of them in a later chapter. But generally speaking, we must build our own telescopes to judge the empirical claims of contemplatives. Judging their metaphysical claims is another matter. Many of them can be dismissed as bad science or bad philosophy after merely thinking about them. But to determine whether certain experiences are possible, and if possible, desirable, and to see how these states of mind relate to the conventional sense of self, we have to be able to use our attention in the requisite ways. Primarily, this means learning to recognize thoughts, as transient appearances in consciousness, and to no longer be distracted by them, if only for short periods of time. This may sound simple enough, but actually accomplishing it can take a lot of work. Unfortunately, it is not work that the Western intellectual tradition knows much about. Lost in thought. When we see a person walking down the street talking to himself, we generally assume that he is mentally ill, provided he's not wearing a headset of some kind. But we all talk to ourselves constantly. Most of us merely have the good sense to keep our mouths shut. We rehearse past conversations, thinking about what we said, what we didn't say, what we should have said. We anticipate the future, producing a ceaseless string of words and images that fill us with hope or fear. We tell ourselves the story of the present, as though some blind person were inside our heads who required continuous narration to know what is happening. Wow, nice desk. I wonder what kind of wood that is. Oh, but it has no drawers. They didn't put drawers in this thing? How can you have a desk without at least one drawer? Who are we talking to? No one else is there. And we seem to imagine that if we just keep this inner monologue to ourselves, it is perfectly compatible with mental health. Perhaps it isn't. As I was working to finish this book, we experienced a series of plumbing leaks in our house. The first appeared in the ceiling of a storage room. We consider ourselves genuinely lucky to have found it, because this was a room we might have gone months without entering. A plumber arrived within a few hours, cut the drywall, and fixed the leak. A plasterer came the next day, repaired the ceiling, and painted it. This sort of thing happens eventually in every home, I told myself, and my prevailing feeling was of gratitude. Civilization is a wonderful thing. Then a similar leak appeared in an adjacent room a few days later. Contact information for both the plumber and the plasterer was at my fingertips. Now I felt only annoyance and foreboding. A month later, the horror movie began in earnest. A pipe burst, flooding 600 square feet of ceiling. This time the repair took weeks and created an immense amount of dust. Two cleaning crews were required to deal with the aftermath, vacuuming hundreds of books, drying and shampooing the carpet, and so forth. Throughout all this, we were forced to live without heat, for otherwise the dust from the repair would have been sucked into the vents, and we would have been breathing it in every room of the house. Eventually, however, the problem was fixed. We would have no more leaks. And then, last night, scarcely 1 month after the previous repair, we heard the familiar sound of water falling onto carpet. The moment I heard the first drops, I was transformed into a hapless, uncomprehending, enraged man racing down a staircase. I'm sure I would have comported myself with greater dignity had I come upon the scene of a murder. A glance at the ballooning ceiling told me everything I needed to know about the weeks ahead. Our home would be a construction site once again. Of course, a house is a physical object beholden to the laws of nature, and it won't fix itself. From the moment my wife and I grabbed buckets and salad bowls to catch the falling water, we were responding to the ineluctable tug of physical reality. But my suffering was entirely the product of my thoughts. Whatever the needs of the moment, I had a choice. I could do what was required calmly, patiently, and attentively, or do it in a state of panic. Every moment of the day, indeed every moment throughout one's life, offers an opportunity to be relaxed and responsive, or to suffer unnecessarily. We can address mental suffering of this kind on at least two levels. We can use thoughts themselves as an antidote, or we can stand free of thought altogether. The first technique requires no experience with meditation, and it can work wonders if one develops the appropriate habits of mind. Many people do it quite naturally. It's called looking on the bright side. For instance, as I was beginning to rage like King Lear in the storm, my wife suggested that we should be thankful that it was fresh water pouring through our ceiling and not sewage. I found the thought immediately arresting. I could feel in my bones how much better it was to be mopping up water at that moment than to be ankle deep in the alternative. What a relief! I often use thoughts of this kind as levers to pry my mind loose from whatever rut it has found on the landscape of unnecessary suffering. If I had been watching sewage spill through our ceiling, how much would I have paid merely to transform it into fresh water? A lot. I am not advocating that we be irrationally detached from the reality of our lives. If a problem needs fixing, we should fix it. But how miserable must we be while doing good and necessary things? And if, like many people, you tend to be vaguely unhappy much of the time, it can be very helpful to manufacture a feeling of gratitude simply by contemplating all the terrible things that have not happened to you, or to think of how many people would consider their prayers answered if they could only live as you are now. The mere fact that you have the leisure to listen to this book puts you in very rarefied company. Many people on earth at this moment can't even imagine the freedom that you currently take for granted. In fact, the effects of consciously practicing gratitude have been studied. When compared to merely thinking about significant life events, contemplating daily hassles, or comparing oneself favorably to others, thinking about what one is grateful for increases one's feelings of well-being, motivation, and positive outlook toward the future. One does not need to know anything about meditation to notice how thinking governs one's mental state. This morning, for instance, I awoke in a state of carefree happiness, and then I remembered the leak. Most readers will be familiar with this experience. Something bad has happened in your life. A person has died, a relationship has ended, you have lost your job. But there's a brief interval after awakening before memory imposes a stranglehold. It often takes a moment or two for one's reasons for being unhappy to come online. Having spent years observing my mind in meditation, I find such sudden transitions from happiness to suffering both fascinating and rather funny, and merely witnessing them goes a long way toward restoring my equanimity. My mind begins to seem like a video game. I can either play it intelligently, learning more in each round, or I can be killed in the same spot by the same monster again and again. Once, while staying in an especially depressing hotel in Kathmandu, I was awakened in the middle of the night by the feeling of a claw scratching my foot. I sat up in terror, convinced that there was a rat in my bed. I had recently learned that the lepers that I had seen throughout my travels in Asia lost their fingers and toes not to the disease itself, but because they could no longer feel pain. This resulted in burns and other injuries. Even worse, rats often ate their extremities while they slept. However, the darkness of my room was perfectly still. It had been only a dream, and as suddenly as it had come, the feeling of terror subsided. My mind and body were now flooded with relief. What a strange dream, I thought. I actually felt a claw on my skin, but nothing was there. The mind is so amazing. And then came the unmistakable sound of something scurrying toward me beneath the sheets. I bounded from the bed with the agility of a Chinese acrobat. After a few interminable moments spent groping in the darkness of an unfamiliar room, I turned on the lights, and all was silent once again. As I stared at the tangle of blankets on the bed, I genuinely hoped that I had lost my sanity, and not, in fact, my privacy. I flung back the covers, and there in the middle of the mattress sat a large brown rat. The creature eyed me with a sickening frankness and intensity. It appeared to be standing its ground, no doubt rueing the loss of such an ample source of protein. I feigned an attack of my own, lunging and shrieking, half ape, half cartoon housewife, and the beast raced across the sheets, sprung to the floor, and disappeared behind the dresser. In the span of a few seconds, my mind had traversed the extremes of human emotion, swinging from terror to exquisite relief and back to terror, entirely on the wings of thought. There's a rat in my bed. Oh, it was only a dream. Rat! Again, I'm not saying that one's thoughts about reality are all that matter. I would be the first to admit that it is generally a good idea to keep rats out of one's bed. But it can be liberating to see how thoughts pull the levers of emotion, and how negative emotions in turn set the stage for patterns of thinking that keep them active and coloring one's mind. Seeing this process clearly can mean the difference between being angry, depressed, or fearful for a few moments, and being so for days, weeks, and months on end. Breaking the spell of negative emotions. Most of us let our negative emotions persist longer than is necessary. Becoming suddenly angry, we tend to stay angry, and this requires that we actively produce the feeling of anger. We do this by thinking about our reasons for being angry, recalling an insult, rehearsing what we should have said to our malefactor, and so forth. And yet we tend not to notice the mechanics of this process. Without continually resurrecting the feeling of anger, it is impossible to stay angry for more than a few moments. While I can't promise that meditation will keep you from ever again becoming angry, you can learn not to stay angry for very long. And when talking about the consequences of anger, the difference between moments and hours, or days, is impossible to exaggerate. Even without knowing how to meditate, most people have experienced having their negative states of mind suddenly interrupted. Imagine, for instance, that someone has made you very angry, and just as this mental state seems to have fully taken possession of your mind, you receive an important phone call that requires you to put on your best social face. Most people know what it's like to suddenly drop their negative state of mind and begin functioning in another mode. Of course, most then helplessly grow entangled with their negative emotions again at the next opportunity. Become sensitive to these interruptions in the continuity of your mental states. You are depressed, say, but you are suddenly moved to laughter by something you read. You are bored and impatient while sitting in traffic, but then are cheered by a phone call from a close friend. These are natural experiments in shifting mood. Notice that suddenly paying attention to something else, something that no longer supports your current emotion, allows for a new state of mind. Observe how quickly the clouds can part. These are genuine glimpses of freedom. The truth, however, is that you need not wait for some pleasant distraction to shift your mood. You can simply pay close attention to negative feelings themselves, without judgment or resistance. What is anger? Where do you feel it in your body? How is it arising in each moment? And what is it that is aware of the feeling itself? Investigating in this way, with mindfulness, you can discover that negative states of mind vanish all by themselves. Thinking is indispensable to us. It is essential for belief formation, planning, explicit learning, moral reasoning, and many other capacities that make us human. Thinking is the basis of every social relationship and cultural institution we have. It is also the foundation of science. But our habitual identification with thought, that is, our failure to recognize thoughts, as appearances in consciousness, is a primary source of human suffering. It also gives rise to the illusion that a separate self is living inside one's head. See if you can stop thinking for the next 60 seconds. You can notice your breath or listen to sounds, but do not let your attention be carried away by thought, any thought, even for an instant. Pause this book and give it a try. Some of you will be so distracted by thought as to imagine that you succeeded. In fact, beginning meditators often think that they are able to concentrate on a single object, such as the breath, for minutes at a time, only to report after days or weeks of intensive practice that their attention is now carried away by thought every few seconds. This is actually progress. It takes a certain degree of concentration to even notice how distracted you are. Even if your life depended on it, you could not spend a full minute free of thought. This is a remarkable fact about the human mind. We are capable of astonishing feats of understanding and creativity. We can endure almost any torment, but it is not within our power to simply stop talking to ourselves, whatever the stakes. It's not even in our power to recognize each thought as it arises in consciousness, without getting distracted every few seconds by one of them. Without significant training in meditation, remaining aware of anything for a full minute is just not in the cards. We spend our lives lost in thought. The question is, what should we make of this fact? In the West, the answer has been, not much. In the East, especially in contemplative traditions like those of Buddhism, being distracted by thought is understood to be the very wellspring of human suffering. From the contemplative point of view, being lost in thoughts of any kind, pleasant or unpleasant, is analogous to being asleep and dreaming. It's a mode of not knowing what is actually happening in the present moment. It's essentially a form of psychosis. Thoughts themselves are not a problem, but being identified with thought is. Taking oneself to be the thinker of one's thoughts, that is, not recognizing the present thought to be a transitory appearance in consciousness, is a delusion that produces nearly every species of human conflict and unhappiness. It doesn't matter if your mind is wandering over current problems in set theory or cancer research. If you are thinking without knowing you are thinking, you are confused about who and what you are. The practice of meditation is a method of breaking the spell of thought. However, in the beginning, you are unlikely to understand just how transformative this shift in attention can be. You will spend most of your time trying to meditate, or imagining that you are meditating, whether by focusing on your breathing or anything else, and failing for minutes or hours at a stretch. The first sign of progress will be noticing how distracted you are. But if you persist in your practice, you will eventually get a taste of real concentration and begin to see thoughts themselves as mere appearances arising in a wider field of consciousness. The 8th century Buddhist adept Vimalamitra described 3 stages of mastery in meditation and how thinking appears in each. The first is like meeting a person you already know. You simply recognize each thought as it arises in consciousness, without confusion. The second is like a snake tied in a knot. Each thought, whatever its content, simply unravels on its own. In the third, thoughts become like thieves entering an empty house. Even the possibility of being distracted has disappeared. Long before reaching this kind of stability in meditation, however, one can discover that the sense of self, the sense that there is a thinker behind one's thoughts, an experiencer amid the flow of experience, is an illusion. The feeling that we call I is itself the product of thought. Having an ego is what it feels like to be thinking without knowing that you are thinking. Consider the following train of thought, a version of which may have already passed through your mind. What is Harris going on about? I know I'm thinking. I'm thinking right now. What's the big deal? I'm thinking, and I know it. How is this a problem? How am I confused? I can think about anything I want. Watch, I'll picture the Eiffel Tower in my mind's eye right now. There it is. I did it. In what sense am I not the thinker of these thoughts? Thus is the knot of self tied. It isn't enough to know in the abstract that thoughts continually arise or that one is thinking at this moment, for such knowledge is itself mediated by thoughts that are arising unrecognized. It is the identification with these thoughts, that is, the failure to recognize them as they spontaneously appear in consciousness, that produces the feeling of I. One must be able to pay attention closely enough to glimpse what consciousness is like between thoughts, that is, prior to the arising of the next one. Consciousness does not feel like a self. Once one realizes this, the status of thoughts themselves as transient expressions of consciousness can be understood. What are we conscious of? We are conscious of the world. We are conscious of our bodies in the world. And we also imagine that we are conscious of ourselves within our bodies. After all, most of us don't feel merely identical to our bodies. We seem to be riding around inside our bodies. We feel like inner subjects that can use the body as a kind of object. This last impression is an illusion that can be dispelled. The selflessness of consciousness is in plain view in every present moment, and yet it remains difficult to see. This is not a paradox. Many things in our experience are right on the surface, but they require some training or technique to observe. Consider the optic blind spot. The optic nerve passes through the retina of each eye.